Okay, this is past John and Bex, because by the time we're actually recording this episode, it's going to be like weeks from now, probably. Got my topics up. Bex is about to pick a number between 1 and 10.
My number is 3.
I knew you were going to pick 3.
No, you didn't. There's like a whole weave of significance why I picked 3. Stop it. I'm so excited.
Utsuro Bune. And this is a USO sighting in Japan in like the 1800s. And it's really fascinating. You're going to think it's really cool, I think.
So I'm going to Alaska on Friday. And the biggest report that I'm exploring is an underwater alien base on the island.
So far, with Jim and with Bex both, they have picked numbers that link to something that is significant to them in some way. Jim absolutely picked the aerial school sighting, which he just knew everything about. So, yeah, it was amazing.
Oh, gotta love it. I knew my number too. As soon as we like made the plan, I was like, I got my fucking number.
All right, now we'll go into theme music. It's gonna start now. Welcome to Randomly Generated Rabbit Holes, a side series by Anomalous Waves. I'm John, your host and all-around sound guy, and today I'm joined by my strange pal, Bex Atwood. Bex is weirdo number 3 of Liminal Earth, owner and operator of Mystic Photo Lab, the internet's first subscription-based film processing club, and a liminal reporter for Night Drift, hosted by our friend, Jim Perry. Like you heard past John and Bex mention, we are going to be talking about Utsuro Bune, also known as the Hollow Ship. Now, like most episodes of Anomalous Waves, there will be many, so many mispronunciations. Even when I look up pronunciations, I butcher them while recording. Absolutely no intention of disrespect, all love, all curiosity. So back when we recorded this, I give a little mini synopsis of the case, and then me and Bex get into it. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Randomly Generated Rabbit Holes. '03 Eastern Japan, off the coast of the Hitachi Province, which is modern-day Ibaraki. Locals saw a strange iron ship with crystal windows drift ashore. Inside, there was a pale-skinned, red, and white-haired woman speaking an unknown language. She held in her hands a square box made of some pale material. The locals didn't know what to do with her, so they packed her back up in the ship and sent her out to sea. Many have claimed this to be an early case of a UFO or, I guess, USO? It wasn't flying or submerged. It was in the middle somewhere. But it was indeed not flying.
I'm just cracking up over it. They just, like, shipped her back.
I know. We're definitely going to be talking about that because that is an interesting part of the tale. But many use this as a, you know, early sighting of a UFO. Or like I said, it's not flying, maybe USO. Maybe it is a crashed ship that's just floating along the sea now. We'll get more into the depths of this story. But first, I'll pass it off to you, Bex. What's like the first thing that you started looking into after hearing this story?
I guess once I got the basics down, you know, kind of what happened, where it happened, when, I think it's really fascinating that this is actually not one, but three separate stories around that time have developed and, you know, have very similar lore. But the first place I kind of went was folklore, because very quickly as you're researching this phenomenon, you see a lot of very academic evaluations. You see a lot of very quickly dismissed portions. Like there's a very large percentage of Japanese historians who just believe that this was a Russian woman who came to like warn them of something. Then other people are really into the idea that it was some like long lost princess. And yeah, but I kind of stumbled upon some lore that was really wild and I love it. So in this version of the account, this kind of focuses on the woman's box at first. And so this box throughout the three different stories is described physically a little different. It goes almost like from like lightsabery in order, like in appearance to an actual box. But in all three stories, she would not let anyone touch it.
Yep.
So this folklore is theorizing that this was a box that protected herself and that no one could touch it because it would threaten her. This is going to get really wild with the pronunciation, but we will try so hard. In one legend, the Totoyama Hime no Mikoto, who is also known as the Otochime, weds Urashima Taro. They were magically transported to Ryaguju, to the Dragon Palace beneath the sea, after saving a turtle who happened to be the daughter of the dragon god Ryujin, also known as Atsuwa Sumi no Mikoto. The events following Taro's marriage to Totoyama is described in a Wikipedia account under the name Urashima Taro. It says Taro stays there with her for a few days, but is soon wants to go back to his village to see his aging mother, so he requests Otohime's permission to leave. The princess says she is sorry to see him go, but wishes him well and gives him a mysterious box called a Tamatebako, which will protect him from harm, but which she tells him to never open. Oh. Taro grabs the box, jumps onto the back of the same turtle that had brought him there, and soon is at the seashore. When he goes home, everything has changed. His home is gone, his mother has vanished, and the people he knew are nowhere to be seen. He asks if anyone knows a man called Urashima Taro. Answer that they had heard of someone of that name had vanished at sea a long time ago. He discovers that 300 years have passed since the day he left for the bottom of the sea. Struck in by grief, he absentmindedly opens the box the princess had given him, from which bursts forth a cloud of white smoke. He is suddenly aged, his beard is long and white, and his back bent. From the sea comes the sad, sweet voice of the princess. I told you not to open your box. In it was your old age.
Oh my God. That is so good.
I know. It's like Dragon World under the sea, turtle transportation.
The 300 years passing, there's a edit John here. Instead of listening to me try and remember what I'm talking about, I will just play the clip. This story was featured on episode 18, Winter Weirdness. One day, a small man rode into King Hurla's court and claimed he was a king as well. In fact, a king of many other kings. He proposed an exchange of visits and declared, "I will attend your wedding, and a year later, you will attend mine." King Hurla did agree, and when his wedding was celebrated, the small king arrived with a large company of servants and a lavish entourage. They supplied everything needed for a perfect banquet, golden goblets and dishes and silken tents. A year later, he came back to King Hurla and claimed it was his own wedding, and Hurla followed him to the small king's kingdom. The entrance was through a crevice in a cliff face. At first, the way was pitch black. But eventually, as they moved down into the mountain, it was lit by magical light, and they entered a large room where the other world's king's wedding took place. They feasted and reveled for 3 days, and King Hurla and his men were sent home with all manner of fairy gifts. Horses, hounds, hawks, and hunting gear. A particular gift given to King Hurla himself was a small bloodhound, and he was given specific instructions to never dismount on any account until the hound does first of his own accord. When back to their own realm, and in daylight, they came upon a shepherd. King Hurla asked news of his queen. The man could barely understand the speech of Hurla, for he was a Saxon. But at length he replied that there was indeed some story of a queen by that name who had been wife to a King Hurla many, many years ago, who, he said, disappeared in the company of a fairy king at this very cliff and was never seen on earth again. It is now 200 years since the Saxons came and took possession of this kingdom. Hurla, amazed at this news, because he believed he had only been gone 3 days, almost fell from his horse. It was good luck he did not, for some of his group, who forgot the instructions of the fairy king before, dismounted, and as soon as they touched the ground, dissolved into dust.
It makes me think of, like, time travel doesn't have to be nuts and bolts either. Like, there's this, like, secret world, and this princess gave you the gift of time travel. If you would have not opened the fucking box, like, you could have lived as a person from the past 300 years into the future just fine, and you could have maybe lived forever, I don't know. But because you decided not to take princess's advice, you aged.
That's really interesting, because there's something else that I found that I'll bring up later that also has to do with gaining immortality from something and living a certain amount of years. But now that she would never let go of the box, like you said, didn't open the box, anything. So very interesting and very strange.
I think it's important to talk about some of the details of just like her and the ship. The ship's like structure materials are very interesting. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about the ship, I guess, first is that it wasn't abnormal for there to be round ships that looked like this in Japan at that time. And even in the 7th century, it was very common. And so I can see why people... I was actually, funny story, reading this research to one of my relatives, and he was like, so you're telling me that an Irish woman got lost at sea and this is a UFO incident? Like, what? You know? And so I get that perspective, especially when you're reading like the construction materials of the ship, when you're starting to discover some of like the Russian fashions at the time and the fake red hair, the white mm-hmm. powder in the hair, the strange fabrics. So there's a lot of Japanese historians who are like, no, this is just a tale about the fears that the Japanese people had of Western culture. Yep. And so I get that. But we're also people who are like, why not both? Why not multiple things? We love the folklore. Mm-hmm. But the ship composite is really weird. And so it's like 10 feet, almost 11 feet high, 17, almost 18 feet wide. And it was appeared to be made of red coated rosewood, while the lower part was covered in brazen plates, obviously to protect it against the sharp edged rocks. The upper part had several windows made of glass or crystal, covered with bars and clogged with some kind of tree resin. Mm-hmm. The shape of the hollow boat resembled a wooden rice pot. The windows were completely transparent, and it baffled the fishermen when looking inside. The inner side of the hollow boat was decorated with text written in an unknown language. But, like, again, I get where they're coming from, because, like, Japanese versus, you know, Russian or Irish or whatever you theorize this woman coming from, of course that would look very foreign. Even in, you know, the 1800s to fishermen. I'm sure that, you know, TikTok is foreign to fishermen, you know, today in Alaska. So I get it. But what was weird were like the contents of the inside of the ship too, which mm-hmm. is like very human contents. It's, you know, bed sheets, a bottle filled with water, cake, and then some kneaded meat. And so it's very different from a lot of the extraterrestrial encounters that you hear where, like, she has rations and she has, like, things that are making her stay more comfortable in the boat, but, like, the composite of the boat is, like, from earthly materials. And so it's hard for me to kind of jump on the USO train. Like you said, it isn't submerged. It's kind of like a top, like a topper thing. Those toys is what that reminded me of. And then that type of ship not being abnormal in Japan at the time, and even back in the 7th century. That's what's so weird. And so I know for a while before I stumbled upon the folklore, I was like, man, like, this is interesting. Like, this is one case where I've really kind of, I'm starting to agree with, like, the skeptical side and the historic side. Mm-hmm. And then when I found that folklore, I was like, oh.
Oh, but I see. It's also important to note, you know, during that period, the Edo period, but it was closed borders, very isolated culture. And they were extremely interested in a lot of things that were really weird and supernatural during that time. And, you know, going back, Bex, you mentioned there's three tales or whatever. The kind of, like, main one comes from Kyokete Bakken and his book, I'll just say the translation, Stories from the Rabbit Garden. So I looked up this article from this man named Zach Davison. He has a whole website. He's a scholar of Japanese folklore and ghosts. Has a whole website where he translates stories, and it's really cool. But he talks about how he was, you know, an intellectual of the time, or like a man of culture. And him and this whole crew of weirdos would meet up once a month and just tell each other weird stories. And it was called the Rabbit Garden. And I love that so much. but the kind of like detailed account, which, you know, most likely came from the earlier version. But this is like one of the more detailed accounts. In it, he talks about this weird incident, but there's no supernatural element really in the story. It's very like just kind of like detailed, like an eyewitness account. You know, it talks about the date, 22nd of February in 1803. It talks about the fisher folk, like, finding the vessel, and that it measured about 3.3 meters and 5.5 meters wide, you know, and their descriptions, a lot of times people will describe it the only way they can, you know, with whatever words they have to describe what it looks like. So I heard a lot of like red lacquered rosewood, like you brought up, but in this translation, it says what looked like. So I'm wondering if like that was just their descriptor of what it could look like. There was weird writing in there. And you and I, before we started, talked about this, the symbols being very interesting. And if they're like translating those symbols exactly, that doesn't look like any British or English type of symbols to me. Very cool symbols, but not that. So the lack of the supernaturalness in this account is the part that I find most interesting, which is weird to have like the lack of the weirdness is kind of the most interesting part.
For sure. I think that that's something that we find sometimes, though, in this work is like the lack of weirdness can be so weird. And I mean, this historian, this Japanese historian, Dr. Kazu Tanaka, he was saying that, you know, it's really wild to associate this with a UFO sighting, as the boat never flies or moves on its own, nor does it show any signs of any extraordinary technologies. It just drifts motionless. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's also interesting that you mention the symbols not, you know, registering as any sort of like British or English type language, because there were very, very similar symbols found in a very much so UFO type incident. And that was the Rendlesham Forest incident. And I know maybe we talk about that a little later. I looked into that just a bit. But then these symbols were also found in caves in multiple parts of the world. And so that's what kind of draws me back into the weirdness a little bit. And I'm like, okay, symbols, okay. So whether or not this woman, you know, themselves were extraterrestrial, whether or not this craft was extraterrestrial, the symbols, I think, kind of keep me hanging on a little bit.
Yeah, I don't, like I was saying, never flew. You said it perfectly. Like, there was no, it wasn't even submerged. It was just floating. She also had cake, which made me think of fairy.
That's a layer I didn't. How did I know?
I'm like, I bet those didn't have any salt in them. You should have tasted it.
I know, right? Do you need meat with, need as in K-N-E-A-D, needed meat. Does that have salt in it? These are the questions.
They're usually cured, but did this one, what was this? And it doesn't say, well, obviously maybe they just didn't know how to describe. They just knew it was a baked good and some kind of meat twisted together like a rope.
Interesting. One other thing that Dr. Tanaka pointed out that I thought was really interesting, and it kind of lends more credence into like the folklore side of things too, there being like this secret world. So, he himself found out that the locations, the Haritono Hama and the Harayidori, were actually fictitious. That there's these two locations do not appear on any of the first completing maps of the whole world of Japan in 1907. If the name of the village, city, or place had been changed in history, this would have been noted in some curatorial documents, but there's nothing. And so, Dr. Tanaka thinks that it's rather unlikely that the important places such as Haritono Hama and Harayidori actually could have been forgotten records. Like, he's like, that's really not possible. So here are these two places that are, according to this doctor, completely fictitious.
Mm-hmm.
Almost as fictitious as the dragon world under the sea. So that's interesting too.
That's very interesting. I did get into the weeds a little with the specifics also of like the person they said that owned the village or whatever didn't own any land around there. And all those kind of details did seem to be a little different. Let's go into why they might have just put her back in the ship and pushed the ship away.
Yes.
So in the detailed version, it talks about an elder trying to explain her devout attachment to the box, and described that, you know, it was most likely that her father was a king, and she took a commoner as a lover. That's what it says in this translation. And the king chopped off the guy's head and put it in the box. And then as punishment, they sent her off to sea. And the elder says that this has happened before, that random women have showed up in boats with similar type of things. And I love that, like, everyone's just like, yeah, that's probably it. And they say, like, it's kind of like up to fate to decide what to do with her. So they're worried that they're going to get in trouble if they help her, it sounds like. And then they just push her back out to sea. But I'm kind of like, isn't that already fate that she landed on your shore? How many fates does she have to go through before she gets help? Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm trying to find the text now. I think it was one of those notes that you don't save. And then you're like, oh, crap. Like, this is definitely not. Yeah. But there was one instance where someone claimed up and down that they could see a pinned head in this ship. Head of her lover wasn't in this box, that it was actually pinned and almost adorned in the ship. But, you know, people say things, whatever. I think that's really interesting that they were like, so many people were just like, yes, that's the story. Like, let's get it and go. And so I think that that almost speaks for, like, yeah, that closed border fear. And then mixing that times interest in the supernatural and all of their very colorful folklore. I think when you combine those two things, you can just be like, yes, here's the story. Now,
exactly.
It's wild, though. Especially, like, only 20. And there's the third report that I read, she was only 13. And so it's like, oh, they're just going to send a child back in the ocean with piece of cake and some water.
Yeah, not much. One glass, a couple of waters, some carpet, I guess, to sleep on, and some cake, some kneaded rope meat, and that's it. Did they give her, it doesn't say if they gave her any more food and water, like if you're going to send her adrift again.
No, and that's what's so wild is, like, what if she really was like a princess or a dignitary and she reports back and is like, listen, I tried to like break bread with these people and they sent me back on a death trip. So proceed with the war, you know.
Yeah.
That's wild.
They also mentioned how like calm she was in one of them. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, so does that mean they were just like, yeah, go back? And then she's just like, okay. And just went back in. But it also sounds like maybe this happened at several different shores. So I don't know if it's just the same person over and over again.
When you're first reading into the phenomenon too, I almost was of the mentality at first that this wasn't three separate, like, I didn't think that it was three separate tales of the same phenomenon. I was like, holy crap, did this happen three separate times because of the location varying and the varying characteristics of the woman. At first, I thought that this was like a whole phenomenon and like these ships are washing up with these women, you know, like what's going on? Yeah, it is three of the same tale, though. But, you know, I think another thing that makes it eerie is that calm, cool collectedness. That's, you know, a little uncomfortable to think about, given the situation.
Very interesting, very weird. Like, if I was in that situation, I'd be panicking and jumping out of the boat and like, oh my God, I need help. Like, I don't know.
Land, finally.
Yeah.
Thank you. Do you have food?
Yeah, exactly. So that's super interesting. Another thing to just kind of switch gears a little bit, I found something called the Ninyo, or human fish, in Japanese folklore. There's a podcast called Uncanny Japan by Teresa Matsura, and it's really cool. I just found it. That's one thing I love about the rabbit holes. I just keep finding these good resources that have a bunch of other stuff that's going to send me down even more rabbit holes. These are great, like, little short things too. She's an author and she just studies weird stuff in Japanese folklore and everything. And it's really well researched and well done. But most of the time, the Ninyo is described as a small, grotesque creature with a monkey-like face and a mouth filled with razor-sharp teeth. They don't say, you know, it's not like gender-specific, like mermaid or merman. It's just human fish. But back in the 4th century BC, there was a mention of a Ninyo in a Chinese text, which was roughly translated as Classics of Mountains and Sea. In it, there's a person fish, and it's described as having the voice of a baby and legs. So the baby voice made me think of the crying baby phenomenon that's reported all over the place in folklore, UFO sightings, even some Kiel like UFO reports that mentioned the person also heard, you know, crashing and banging in their house and crying baby. She also discusses that, you know, at one point it kind of meant good luck to find them, but then later definitely meant bad luck. And usually if it washed ashore, it could mean like imminent war, but also times a big storm or a natural disaster would follow, which is another thing that I love is like the storm happening during the supernatural thing. There's so many UFO reports too. In Passport to Magonia and stuff that or like a weird sighting that involves some sort of storm. So Teresa also talks about when she's talking about Nino, the most kind of like, I guess, well-known story involving one called Yao Beckedy. So the legend goes that a fisherman once caught a very strange fish. He had never seen anything like it. He took it home and invited a bunch of friends and family to come try it. Everyone waited while he was preparing the meal, but one guest was eager to see this strange fish, looked inside the kitchen, and saw that it had a human face. He told all the others what he'd seen and told them not to eat it. The fisherman brought out the fish all cut up and on a platter, looking nice. And, you know, everyone just kind of picked it up and like tucked it in their shirts and stuff. Didn't want to offend him, but also was like, we're not eating that. But there was one drunk guy at the party. And she says, as there always is. So he did. He did tuck away the fish like he was supposed to. But when he went home, his daughter was like, do you have anything for me from the party thing that you went to? And he's drunk and he just wants to pass out. So he pulled a chunk of the flesh out and gave it to her. She immediately popped in her mouth and began to chew. She was like, this is delicious. And he was like, oh, God. You know, he kind of realized, snapped out of it what he had done. It was too late. So he kept eye on her, like worried that she'd be poisoned or something, but nothing happened. She was fine. She grew up, says, became a nice lady, got married. Then things changed. She suddenly stopped aging completely. Her husband got old, sick, and died, but she stayed young. She married again, did the same thing. This went on for a couple of husbands till finally she was like, I'm becoming a nun. And she lived her life wandering through various countries until she returned to her hometown at 800 years old and died. So we got long immortality life again.
Coming from the sea, too.
Yep. And like the same period of time.
Mm-hmm.
The Edo period, once again, having the coolest stories. This is going to be something I'm going to be trapped in for a long time. I can always tell.
I was going to say the exact same thing. Like, I am so excited to start to research a culture who is so centered around supernatural things to the point where historians are like, oh, the Edo, you know, they dismiss the Edo history at large because of how deep they were in that lore. And that makes me happy.
I know, me too. Just like the, you know, the rabbit garden club or whatever. Like, I was like, we got to do that.
I was thinking the same thing. I was like, aren't we already kind of doing that though? Like the rabbit holes, the rabbit garden, we're gathering. We're
sharing, wow.
Like, our strange tales. Like, we're literally embodying that right now.
I did not even make that connection. That's so fun. Maybe that's what they meant. Like rabbit holes, getting down the weird stories.
That would make sense, right? Because rabbits have holes in the gardens. And if you fall down them, like, too suddenly, you could twist your ankle. But if you proceed with caution, like, you could find treasures.
Oh, my gosh. Beck's making breakthroughs live. I love
That's what we're here for.
We are keeping that tradition going.
We're making breakthroughs. But I, like, completely overlooked something with the dragon lore that I was reading it again because I was trying to find that comment, that one line about the pinned head. Like, that just won't get out of my head. Mm. I'm like, where did I find that? But after I told you not to open the box, what was in it was your old age. There's like some commentary from the historian that says, here we see that a box called the Tamate Bako played a very important role in the myth. The fact that the woman described in the hollow boat legend as also holding tightly onto the box, which she would not let anyone touch, would indicate that she was in fact an emissary of Ryugu Ju, the dragon palace from beneath the sea, and not an alien from outer space, as theorized by some ufologists. We should keep in mind that the woman in the hollow boat legend is described as having red hair and pinkish skin. If this woman was in fact linked to the dragon palace, then more likely she would have had the red hair too. So they're saying she's not matching up with like a lot of UFO stuff, but she's matching up with like the lore around the dragon palace. and that she looks like the royalty of the Dragon Palace is recorded. So, and the red dragon is like a very personal synchronicity of mine. So that's just creeping me out on a whole different level.
Well, I'm happy to send you down a place where you get reaffirmed with your weirdness again. Get another weird sync slap.
We were like, oh, like, this is a really exciting topic that I didn't know anything about at the time. But I remember one of the last things that we said to each other was, like, let's see how this, like, brings out our personal weirdness and, like, things that we're already exploring. Let's see how this syncs up. So that's to be expected, I guess.
Always to be expected. And yeah. Always loved. Always appreciated. And sometimes gives you shivers in the spooks.
Gives you shivers. Gives you a lot of questions.
Yes.
A lot of whys. I was reading the stuff about the symbols. Like, I was like reading ahead. Sorry, teacher. I was reading ahead just a little bit because it's what I do. And I have like a weird sync. Remember when I was talking about the ship's shape reminding me of Topper, like the toy that you spin? I'm reading. So I found this image of all of the symbols and people are like breaking down what they think it means. And the first one I'm reading says possibly a symbol related to power, authority, or a topper.
Whoa.
And so, fun little sync. I wish I could like switch my camera around. I don't know how to do that right now, but trust me, I guess.
I love that. No, I do. I indeed do. In love when that happens.
I'm reading about Raiguruju, which is the official name for the Dragon Palace Castle, the Undersea Palace of Ryujin. And so this one is pretty much, this Wikipedia page on this is pretty much mentioning this, two things that you mentioned and then one thing I mentioned. Okay, so the first paragraph is mentioning something reportedly appearing on the beach proclaiming to be a messenger from the Ryugu. So they're basically calling this woman a messenger from the Dragon Palace in the first paragraph of this location's Wikipedia. And then there's something else that has a 6 meter long snake-like body that resembles a giant oarfish. And it's also a messenger from the world. But it, yeah, you were just talking about that. that's interesting. It's very interesting. And there's a lot of crystal in the dragon world. So crystal windows, you know, and it's red, rosewood.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting little place there. there's like information on the seasons of the dragons. there's a lot of lore around this place, but it's a 3 days swim beneath. You just go down
for 3 days. Yeah. All right.
Three is an interesting number to be brought up to.
Yeah. That's the number you picked to get this topic.
I forgot about that. Oh man, I mean, yeah, that's so wild. And like the turtle transportation, I love that. But the serpent thing that you mentioned, and then this paragraph just claiming that this woman is just a messenger for them. Like that was what this is. But I guess, okay, so the big question for us, if we play off of that, is what was the message that she had for them? If they send her back in. So if she just shows up, she's not able to really communicate, she's acting weird, what could that have messaged if it was indeed from the Dragon Palace?
They'll never know because they sent her pack in without any offerings or anything. No exchange of anything.
That's what's weird about that to me. Okay, never another layer. People in cultures who revere the supernatural often have very, like, deep, beautiful offering regimens. They believe in a lot of gods, and so that's one of like the first things that you do is you present. So that's another layer that's weird. Why wouldn't they, you know, offer her anything whatsoever? And so maybe they're fearful of the Dragon Palace, and we're like, red hair. Oh no, we know where you're from. You rode in on something that looks like a turtle. We don't want you. Go.
Yeah, that. Oh, yeah. Making breakthroughs live once again.
I know, right? And it's so funny because, like, when I was doing these notes this week, I was gonna, like, really hone in on the USO stuff. And this is kind of, in a way, still doing that. But, like, this has gone completely full fork of, like, this. Instead of an underwater USO base that, like, I hear a lot in, like, Alaska, for instance, this is like, oh, there's an underwater world and it takes 3 days and it's dragons. red everywhere.
Sounds like a base to me.
Sounds like a base to me, yes. Oh, man.
That's the other thing I love about, like, this idea of the rabbit holes is... You start out with this intention. It happened to Andrew, too. He was going to do this certain, like, New York bridges, and he ended up going down a different one because he found this other path more interesting and went that route. You start out with a certain intention of, like, I'm going to talk about this, this, and this. And then you get going, and you fly off a different direction. Love it.
That I think it shows people... kind of just our processes as researchers and as investigators and, I mean, reporters and podcasters. It's like, this is how it goes, though, you know, and oftentimes the format doesn't allow us to be able to do these side tangents. And this is just the way that my brain works. And so for us to, like, oh, well, no, first we have to get through this person, we have to get through this. It's like, well, no, like, we're allowing ourselves to, like, operate how we would naturally. And I think that that's a really cool peak for people who maybe aren't in this world or just listening to this for entertainment purposes or maybe for research themselves, but, you know, do things differently. I think that's important to kind of show people, like, hey, it's okay to have one idea of something and then, like, go a completely different direction. It's okay to think you're investigating and talking about USOs and, you know, you end up talking about dragon places. It's okay. It's not only okay, it's like, that's what I would prefer.
Highly encouraged. The last thing that I looked into, which I've done the last couple times, is going into Jacques Vallée's, like, I think it's in Passport to Magonia. There's like a database of like 100 years of UFO sightings, and it just has the dates and then the sightings. And I just go into the, like, PDF version and search certain keywords of whatever rabbit hole we're in. So first off, I did some fishermen ones. So July 2nd, 1950, Sleep Rock Lake, Canada. A man and his wife saw a double saucer with portholes and a rotating antenna come to the rest on the surface of the lake. 10 figures, 1.2 meters tall, dressed in shiny clothing, emerged and walked on deck like robots, changing direction without turning their bodies. Their faces could not be seen. One of them wore a red cap, had darker arms and legs, and seemed to be their chief. They immersed a hose in the lake, then took off. Fishermen later reported a green moss forming on the lake. So that's just a random fisherman kind of story, but I thought that was a really weird account.
Red hat.
Red hat. Oh, there you go. Red hat.
I love, like, mysterious moss too.
Right? It's given me a lot of, like, creep show image vibes of, like, Stephen King covered in the green moss or whatever. But yeah, like, just robot like aliens putting a hose in a lake and 10 of them. Very interesting.
Could you imagine? That's what I always go back to just in the back of my mind when I read these reports, when you're taking these reports from witnesses, when you're doing all of this kind of work, like, how would you react if you saw 10, like, robots putting a hose into the water?
Like, hey, what are you putting in there?
Hey, you! Hey, what are you doing? Oh, my God. No, that's the thing, though, is, like, as soon as you see that movement, you know something's wrong, right? And so, like, for me, I feel like I would get, like, the really bad bubble guts. Like, oh no, something's amiss.
And then just crawl away into a bush.
Where's the bathroom?
You gotta get the hell out of here. For more than one reason.
That's so, like, hey, kill.
You gotta get the hell out of here.
That was such a good one. Oh, my God. Anyways.
Okay, another fisherman story. December 25th, Christmas, 1963, Libreville. A fisherman witnessed the landing of a craft from which a terrifying creature emerged. It was humanoid in shape, spoke sounds he could not understand, left footprints on the sand, and went back to the machine and flew off. Another very cool fisherman story. Similar in this way, that spoke some sort of language that he didn't understand.
Interesting.
And left footprints. So some sort of kind of physical proof. So we have green moss and we have footprints. Then I found like a couple from Japan. It seemed like there was maybe a little bit of a flap in 1957-58. So Pacific Ocean near Japan. Japanese fishermen saw two metal discs come into the sky, and this was followed by violent turbulence, which makes you think when it came over, there was some sort of force that made the boat of the fisherman shake, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Then, you know, the next year in January 26, 1958, Shimada City, Japan, a very bright object landed before numerous chemical workers. They reported beings falling from the sky without parachutes. They wore strange suits and spoke an unknown language. So not even a year later, now these chemical workers see, once again, a bunch of beings parachuting from the sky. And then when they land, they're speaking an unknown language.
That's, wow.
Very cool.
Just imagine like pictures of people just falling out of the sky.
I know. Very weird. But also could be they didn't have parachutes. That's other, you know, obviously they would have recognized them if they saw parachutes. Just like a week later, February 2nd, 1958, a farmer and his son see an egg-shaped object that just lands silently, like in their field. We've heard that many times, but I thought it was, you know, really cool that it was like just like a week later. So 57, 58, there was some stuff going on. December 1963, Japan, it says exact location unknown. A Japanese man reported the landing of an object from which emerged a being who spoke to him in a language he could not understand, climbed aboard again, and flew away. So that seems to be like, of course, that's what would happen. But there's like several relating specifically to Japan or specifically to fishermen where there attempts to be some sort of contact, spoken contact. Because a lot of times you'll hear these reports of like telepathy where it's like they just know the language or like they understand it almost through feeling of what the beings are talking about. But this is specifically like vocal cord spoken words that they can't understand, which is interesting.
That's so interesting. Talking it up to interesting, my thought juices are going.
Thought juices is a great term.
I don't know. I've been reading a lot of UFO encounters recently where like the contact is almost always seemingly more telepathic, right? And so it's very rare, I think, for modern UFO reports for them to be like, they're speaking a language I couldn't understand unless they're overhearing or eavesdropping, right? But when there's an actual attempted contact situation, it's almost always telepathic. And so I think that makes that account more exceptional because, the lips were moving, there were like actual sounds. And that's interesting because that then puts me into the perspective of like the extraterrestrial or whatever in question. Like, why would you mutter something that they couldn't understand when you could telepathically do it like the other guys? Like, what's different there, and why? What productiveness comes from speaking to someone and they can't understand you?
Yeah.
So, but it could just be, I don't know.
They don't have the ability to do that.
Yeah.
That
right.
Type of communication, maybe. But I all these stories that I read are pretty much all the ones that had Japan fishermen or whatever in it. And most of them mention, you know, I think three of them mentioned not being able to understand the language. And I've read tons of these reports, and that's not like a thing that I see all the time. So it's weird that when I use those keywords specifically, those connections are made to the original case we were talking about. So I also typed in red hair. I wanted to see if any other red hair beings. I found one. October 25th, 1957. I'm going to pronounce this wrong. Petropolis, Brazil. A girl suffering from cancer appeared about to die, and the house was suddenly illuminated by a strong light, as if a searchlight had been aimed at the room. It came from an object whose top part was reddish yellow. Two figures emerged from it and entered the house. They're about 1.2 meters tall, had long yellow red hair, small green slanted eyes, and wore white gloves and glowing white clothes. Mm. Before the astounded witness, the author of the report, and the family of the girl, they used a device producing a bluish white light and another instrument in what appeared to be radiation treatment of the patient. After 30 minutes, they went away, leaving her completely cured. The report was anonymous at the end.
Of course.
But I don't think he would have included it unless he thought it was interesting.
Right.
Knowing Valet. So we have about the same height. Red hair again.
Mm-hmm.
I like the glowing white clothes.
Mm-hmm. I think that lines up with like the mysterious fabric because it was white.
Pretty weird. A lot of times, you know, typing in those random keywords into this will send me down other kind of weird rabbit holes. So I find it really cool.
So I guess where my mind went next was maybe this like dragon palace, or I guess what we would call just like an underwater base. Maybe they're not only, you know, off Japan, right? Maybe they're in Brazil because Brazil has such wild activity. It's like number one or number three in the world, as far as countries go for UFO reports, just in volume. And you could say, oh, it's because it's a huge country, but like, okay, Russia, there you go. But that makes me think of something I was originally going to talk about in regards to the USOs. And it was my own personal gathering of eyewitness reports on my dad's island in Alaska in Southeastern, which, you know, shares a body of water with Japan. Technically, Japan or Russia would be the first places that we could go if we were to just head west from Dad's Island. So eyewitness reports from the first people tribes that are there, the Tlingit and the Haida, they fully 100% believe that there's some sort of like USO underwater alien base, and they use alien specifically because they're constantly seeing weird glowy things under the water. They're constantly seeing weird aerial activity that appears to go boom into the water. And so, you know, that just makes me think, if it's not subterranean, some subterranean world, maybe it is a base of sorts, and maybe it's not just in Japan. Maybe, you know, it's in Brazil, maybe it's in Alaska. And it's like the fishermen in both of those, in all three of those places, would be some of the ones who would be closest to that base, right? So I think that we need to really listen to our fishermen when they say these things. And it makes me just want to dive down like New Fork and things, those websites, and just be like, all right, fishermen, where are we at?
Yeah, I've thought of putting just fishermen stories on rabbit holes plenty of times, because I'm like, just being out in these huge bodies of water, there's just bound to be some really strange encounters. And that's really cool. Okay, so we started off thinking, I think we both thought that we're specifically going to be talking about just USO type things the whole time. And we both went kind of down our own folklore rabbit holes, which I love and I appreciate so much. I don't really know what to say, except if you do a rabbit hole, you're just gonna go wherever you go.
I think something that's important is like, don't be too rigid with your rabbit hole exploring. Don't have a whole lot of expectations. You know, when you're picking a topic, I feel like it's better to do it blindly and then follow it because it may have, you know, very personal sinks that follow you.
Yes. Very cool. Well, thank you so much, Bex. This is a good time for you to do, you know, like a shameless plug. Where can people find you? What projects are you excited about? All that jazz.
Yes. So main project, my main dudes over at Liminal Earth. You can find our worldwide map, completely 100% crowdsourced map of strange stories and accounts, anything from like grandma, ghost in the basement, to weird dreams, to dogs wearing shoes. You have it. Submit it to our map. We'd love to share it. So that's at liminal.earth. So think .com, but .earth. You can also find us on socials across the board at Liminal Earth. I'm Bex in the Liminal, so you can find me across the board with that name. I report fairly often for Night Drift. I also help co-host a cute internet cable access show with Katie Webb called Katie and Bex Live. Next week, we're going to have John Tenney on, so that's going to be extra exciting. Yeah, and I'm currently traveling all over the Midwest right now, so get ready for those reports and TikToks.
Yes. Thank you so much for joining me down the rabbit hole, Bex. Please do it again.
I'll be back.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Randomly Generated Rabbit Holes. Thank you to Bex for joining me. If you want to support the show, head over to anomalouswaves.com for all them links. There you will find the best way to support the show by joining our Patreon. There's also a link to our merch store. We got some very cool new stuff in there, as well as some tip jar options. You'll also find a very easy way to directly message us on there. Send us a story or just reach out to say hey. You can also find us on all the socials at Anomalous Waves. Another great way to support the show is to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. That always helps get some new ears on the show. But the easiest, best way to support the show is to just tell someone about it. Tell someone who washes ashore your little fishing village, and after you push them back out to sea, just yell, "Oh yeah, don't forget to check out Anomalous Waves. It's a podcast discussing all things strange." Or, you know, just tell anyone who likes anything weird. All right, that's it. Thanks so much for listening. Bye. All right, Edit John here once again. So I guess when I interrupt from now on, you'll hear a ghost horse whinny. That's a new thing. I thought since, you know, last Anomalous Waves episode, I ended with a Liminal Earth story using the random story function. And since I just interviewed Bex, I thought that was a good idea. So I'm just going to do it right now. I'm going to liminal.earth and I'm going to use the random story generator. This is Emerald Heights Apartments Entity. And it's under Cryptoids and Straight Up Ghosts. April 23rd, 2017. So I've had tons of experiences, but this haunts me most still. Our apartment was set up as follows. Enter front door. You're in the living room, which is also the dining room. About 10 feet forward, you turn left, and to the left of that is the kitchen, and to the right is a hallway with all the rooms. The first two on the left are my brother's room and the bathroom. All the way back was my parents' room, and to the right was the room I shared with my sisters. My younger sister and I were sitting in our room with the door open. All the lights were off since it was night, and we were watching TV on my iPad. I don't know what it was, but I got this urge to look up, and in the hallway was this creature I'm not sure I really know how to describe. Its body looked like a person's. I'm sure it stood to be about 6-7 feet tall. but it was pure white and translucent. You could see the darkness behind it through its skin. It was skinny. You could see every bone in its twisted body. The way it moved is what really frightens me. It was like it was doing a back bend and it moved slowly down the hall like that. I wasn't sure what to do, but then it looked at us. It wasn't a slow movement either. One second it's looking in the darkness of my parents' room, and the next it's making eye contact with me. There was no face, just two glowing white sunken orbs I can only assume were its eyes. I wanted to scream, but nothing came out. I was frozen in fear, and then it scurried into my parents' room. It took a second before I was able to move again, but when I looked at my sister to ask if she'd seen it, I didn't have to say a thing. She looked petrified. I don't know what that was or where it went. I've never seen it again since then. Submitted by Moss on July 19th, 2021, tagged Astoria, Oregon. Okay, well, super spooky. No syncs with what we were talking about, but maybe a sync with someone who's listening right now. Or maybe it was just the perfect random story for spooky season. Either way, I love the random story function. I'm going to use it so often. Thank you, Liminal Earth. Thank you, Bex. Okay, for reals now, I'm going to go. Ghost Horse, Winnie out.